The core foundation of the Buddha's Dharma, his teaching, occurred when he had a great insight, which is referred to as Iddhipakkhayata. Ridiculous word to spell. You don't have to know it. You don't have to memorize it. Noah makes fun of me for all the times I quote Pali words, so I'm just putting it out there in case you're interested. But basically, what's formulated in this teaching is the idea that everything that occurs in the mind occurs for a reason. The mind is not a place where accidents happen, where gods intervene and start implanting ideas or thoughts in our head. That actually what happens in the mind, the emotional states, the thoughts, the moods, the perceptions, they're all caused. The mind is basically a causal environment. And what causes, the dominant cause of everything, is the way we've used the mind in the past. That's the foundation of karma. The way we use our mind creates the mind we live in the future. Neuroscientists now call this neurons that fire together, wire together. What it basically means is that if we act out or think thoughts that are angry, those thoughts just won't happen in isolation. We'll be more likely to have anger and resentment in our lives in the future. There's, in fact, an entire subsystem of the mind called the striatum, which records our thoughts, the ones that we think regularly, and starts suggesting these thoughts, providing them for us. They become habitually ingrained. Now, the Buddha has taught that causation can happen over a long period of time, it can happen over a very short period of time, or it can happen immediately. I'll give some examples. I mean, out in the world, we're used to causation all the time. In the 1970s, gas prices were raised by OPEC, and when the gas prices raised, consumers had fewer dollars to spend. It was more expensive to ship goods. And as a result, fewer people bought commodities. More people were laid off. The economy went on a slide. And when the economy went on the slide and people were laid off their jobs, the crime rate soared. So the long-term result of raising gas prices was unemployment and crime. That's an example of a long-term causal chain. Of course, if you lower unemployment rate, then crime eventually goes down with it. So, in our own lives, we see long-term causation all the time. If I start trying to figure out how my future will play out, or if I try guessing what other people are thinking about me, these are thoughts of speculation that involve myself. Whenever I combine thoughts of moi and speculation, stress and suffering are sure to follow down the road. I become anxious, because when the mind starts guessing what's going to happen to me, how am I going to pay the bills in the future, etc., etc., because those are unknowable. There's too many factors that cannot be determined. The mind gleefully fills them in, often with the worst possible case scenarios. Especially if you were raised on the Upper West Side by Jewish parents. And even if you weren't. So, actually my dad was Catholic, but they were pretty good at that too. So, so that's long term. Then there's shorter term. if you walk up to somebody and, or you walk up to me and say something nasty, boy, I don't like your tattoos. What a ridiculous look you have, fatso. I might have a delayed reaction, but pretty soon I'll probably have a sense of, well, that's wrong. Oh, there you are, they right? Maybe I am fat. Where's the mirror? So that's an example of like somewhat medium. Then there's vaguely immediate causation. If I stub my toe, the pain feels pretty instantaneous. It's not. Actually, it takes a while for the C nerve, whatever they are, to reach, go up the spine, to be reached the thalamus, rewired to the somatosensory lobe of the parietal region of the brain. Oh my God, why do I know this? To be registered and then for pain to be announced in the brain. So that actually takes about a half a second. So pain is not in, is not at the exact same moment that the incident occurs. There's a slight delay. But it feels pretty instantaneous because consciousness tends to align the two events even though they happen separately. Now there's also, the Buddha noted that there's simultaneous causation. And this is the one that's perhaps the most interesting. It happens when there are such things known as dualities, such as black and white, things that, or states that contain conceptually the whole of our experience, and you're generally in one or the either. To use an external example of a duality, in American politics, they're pretty much right now just the Democrats and the Republicans. I wish there were many parties, but that's a talk for another evening, and a talk that I am not the best one to give. But in general, there's just Democrats and Republicans right now pretty much in power. So what's ever good for the Democrats almost at the exact same moment is bad for the Republicans. What's good for the Republicans is almost invariably bad for the Democrats. After the Democratic primary, the job statistics came out. It wasn't that good. The Republicans loved that because they could use that for their election, which was bad, their campaigns, which was bad for the Democrats. You get it. Whenever there's a duality, what affects one will affect the other. Let's look at it more conceptually, easier to understand. For example, if I divide this room into left and right, and I'm going to have to reverse it, so this is left for you. That's left for you, I hope. So if I say, everybody look left, at the exact same moment you are looking left, you are not looking right. You are looking away from the right as you look to the left. That's a common occurrence in dualities. Whenever you're running towards one, you're running away from the opposite state. If I tell you in a moralistic worldview to always be good, that's not getting rid of bad or evil. In fact, the more you think about always being goody two-shoes, bad or evil thoughts are just as much becoming present. Because whenever you focus on one part of a duality, you are at the same time creating a fear of the other. The same that goes with mine and not mine, self, other. Whenever I focus on what's mine, I worry about what's not mine. Whenever I focus on what's self, I worry about what's not self. I become more fearful of what's out there. So the Buddha didn't avoid all dualities, but for this reason, he tended to use them as sparingly as possible, because they're of very limited use. You cannot get rid of one concept of a duality simply by chasing the other. The more you crave one half of a duality, you are giving energy and keeping the other one just as much alive. I mentioned this in the talk I gave on it last night, so I'll do it again. Those of you who have ever read the work of Jacques Derrida will recognize this. He made a nice career out of analyzing books that tried to prove one point and showed how, in so doing, they constantly created the exact opposite argument. So, we're now going to use all these concepts of causation and duality to talk about something that's very important in all our lives, which are feelings. We all have them. What are feelings? Feelings are not emotions. Feelings are largely unconscious reactions to what's occurring in the present moment. They're driven by parts of the brain that are unconscious, the amygdala, hypothalamus. And what they do is they register what's going on right now and they determine whether they're happy with the state of affairs. They think our chances of survival are improving. Or if they're unhappy and they think we're involved with something that's threatening our long-term survival. When we feel a sense of comfort, that's because our unconscious is saying, oh good, I've got food, I'm surrounded by nice people, I like what this person's saying, I like the thought of pizza. There's a box of donuts, this is great, I like these people, I like this TV show, this is good. Internet sale, hooray! I like this. I always feel good when something's on sale. Life is good. Then on the other hand, there's discomfort, which is the feeling of, I don't like this. Holy shit, why is he looking at me that way? Oh my God, that's a bill I haven't opened. I don't want to open it. I have a paper I have to write. Shit. I'm supposed to do something. Fuck. Sunday evening. This sucks. Because Monday's going to be soon. So what happens is there's an underlying feeling tone, which the Buddha called Vedana, there I go again with my Pali, that arises in reaction to every event. It's almost instantaneous. It doesn't happen at the same time, but it's very quick. That's what's known as a causal relation. I'm going to read you the great description of what feelings are by the renowned neuroscientist Antonio Damasio. He goes, we often realize that in a given situation that we feel anxious and uncomfortable or pleased and relaxed. And it's apparent that this particular state of feeling did not begin on the moment of knowing, but before. In other words, it's so fast, it's pre-conscious, these feeling tones. And there are only really two. There's comfort and there's discomfort. There's a third state, which is neither one nor the other, which means that you really don't view what's happening as affecting you either way. But most of the time, we're in either one or the other. We're comfortable or we're uncomfortable. Why are we in one or the other? Because we only have a single nervous system. So you can't have more than one dominant comfort or discomfort feeling at once. Now, the causation, though, is more interesting than just that. Because, suppose, for example, you're in a long-term shitty state of your life. You're depressed, and the brain has been focusing your mind exclusively on things that bring about unease. The thoughts are ones of self-loathing. And so, for days in and out, you've been in a state of discomfort because the mind is focusing your awareness on things that create discomfort. Then one day you wake up on the other side of the bed. I don't know what that saying means, but I'm running with it. The other side of the bed, you're happy. Suddenly somebody says something nice, or for some reason your mind is focused on a recognition of all the hard work you've done, or the antidepressants you've taken are taking effect, or I don't know what. But suddenly, you're in a state of comfort. Well, that comfort will feel even better because what preceded it was so shitty. The shittiness of the depression will make the comfort feel much better. Let's look at it the other way. You're in love. You're irritating all your friends. Everything is great. All the problems in life have vanished because you've met Ms. Wright or Mr. Wright or somebody who's transitioning from Mr. to Ms. Wright. We're open to all. We embrace all. So you've met the right person, and everything they say is wonderful, and all the adrenaline and dopamine and acetylcholine is flooding your brain, and you're high on happiness, and nothing will ever be bad again. And then, bang! One day the happy neurotransmitters have dried up, and suddenly everything they say is not terrific anymore, and they're even vaguely irritating. And what are they doing talking to me over breakfast? I hate that. And why is your toothbrush in my cup? And whatever. So suddenly you're in a state of discomfort. Well, all that wonderful period will now affect the discomfort and make it seem even worse. People often break up just at that moment simply because the inevitable downturn feels that much more appalling because everything that happened before has conditioned the discomfort. All the ease and good feelings before have made the inevitable moments of in a relationship feel worse than I like that sound. It makes it feel like that sound. So feelings are not just determined by the triggers, the perceptions, the way we use our mind, but they're also conditioned by what preceded them. Now, all this would be fine. We live happy lives with feelings of content and discontent, ease and unease, comfort and discomfort, flowing back and forth with the tides of life. If it weren't for the fact that we have minds that want one thing, the mind we are born into wants to have comfort all the time. The human mind wants to lead a life free of any discomfort, any pain, any setback, anything that feels bad. The mind views discomfort as evil. The mind believes that comfort is always good because it feels good. And thus the things in life that feel good, we vaunt and we add all these thoughts around them. I like this. If I like it, it must be good. Donuts are good. Ice cream is very good. Ice coffee in the morning is terrific. In the evening, not so much. Bills are bad. I wish we didn't have bills. I wish we didn't have conflicts, difficult conversations. How unfair is that? I wish it was all love all the time. And that life never required awkward situations. So, we add all this, what the Buddha called papancha, thoughts and thoughts about justifying the things we like to do that make us feel good and demonizing the things that don't make us feel good. What's the problem? The problem is all growth, learning anything, developing new skills, all of that requires tolerating discomfort. Everything we learn in life, we suck at the beginning, and that doesn't feel good. I use the example of learning to skateboard when I was 45. That sucked. Horribly. When you're 12 and you fall off something that rolls around, it's not awful. It's, oh, I did what a 12-year-old does. Everybody, all of my friends are doing. When you're 45, there's a part of the brain that goes, what the fuck is the matter with you? And the 10-year-olds standing around are saying the same thing, too. And you don't have the balance, so you're definitely not good at it. And, you know, I've learned to play the banjo and the accordion. Anybody who picks up an accordion is going to suck. Just looking at an accordion sucks. Picking it up and trying to make sense of things that are pulling and pushing and have one buttons and keys and everything's happening in different ways is horrible. But I learned because I developed tolerance for discomfort. Learning a computer application. Learning to... any new skill, meditation, a new exercise routine, martial arts, whatever it is you're interested in, if you want to continue to grow and keep the mind fresh and constantly rewiring it, it requires tolerating discomfort. Not only that, a lot of the skillful things in life require stepping through discomfort. Forgiving, that doesn't feel good. Making amends when I've done something that's hurtful or have said something that I later regret. That doesn't feel good. Much rather avoid the person for the rest of my life. Much rather hide behind the corner or across the street. There's a great book called The Road Less Traveled by some... Yeah, and Scott Peck, that was all about how all of the valuable tools we develop in life require walking through discomfort, tolerating discomfort. But the mind doesn't like that. So what we need to do is develop the tools that allow us to do the things we avoid. The paying of the bills, the sending out of the resume when we need a job, the making amends when we feel shame over something, the calling up someone that we might feel angry with but we want to renew contact with, the forgiveness of parents and friends that we still want to have in our life, even the forgiveness of people we need to keep ourselves separate from. All of this requires tolerating discomfort. And in order to do this, we need to have a mind that doesn't add all that papancha and self-justification keeping us away from doing what doesn't feel easy. And that's what we practice in meditation. What we're doing when we allow discomfort at the beginning of our meditation, we note the state of the body and the mind without reacting, without pushing away, without judging ourselves. What we're doing is we're creating a state of mind that simply allows states of ease and dis-ease, comfort and discomfort to arise and pass. We're developing tolerance. We're developing ease in life. Now, in life, when we encounter things that create discomfort, the general tendency of the human mind is to try to get rid of those things. If we're around somebody that is challenging, we want to kill them or avoid them at all costs. We want to change reality by getting ourselves away. Sometimes that's a good idea, but often... not killing them, getting away, I should say. But often, there's a tool that's skillful that's available to us that we don't use, which is, if we have to go through something that's uncomfortable for our own long-term happiness, we can still create greater ease if we turn inwards. We work with the breath. We find where stress is registered in the body, where our tendency to react and push away, the arms, the muscles in the shoulders especially. We tend to hold our old, deeper feelings in our stomach and in our chest, and those are wounds from the past. But reactivity to the present is always in the fight or flight muscles. Yeah, I know you suck, and I'm ready for you to say something sucky. So we tense these muscles in the jaw and the forehead and the muscles in the neck. So we go to those muscles and we breathe and we relax before we have a meeting with someone who we are not looking forward to. We can use deep breaths. We can think thoughts of skillful thoughts. Thoughts of gratitude for what we've accomplished or the fact that we're doing something that in the long term will be towards our benefit or the benefit of others. We can reflect on other people who've overcome even greater difficulties than ourselves. Work through problems that far surpass the problems that we're working through. There are so many tools within. So we don't just have to settle with simply tolerating discomfort when we're doing things that are necessary but don't feel good. We can also learn to literally bring ease within. And that's a skillful form of working with discomfort. What's not skillful is demanding that the world change every time we feel ill at ease. That's the kind of behavior that winds up in addiction, avoidance, and a life that becomes smaller and smaller and more confined and less experimental and less courageous. So I hope that in tonight's talk there was something for you to ponder, that any wisdom that managed to creep into tonight's words goes out in all directions to all beings. And at this point, I offer the room to you to share on any subject or ask any question you want related to spiritual endeavor, and I thank you for listening.